The Capital Connection is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection. Support comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org. And New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us this week is one of our favorites, Heather Bruschetti, the president and CEO of the Business Council of New York State. That's the head business lady in the whole state. Welcome, Heather, and I'm glad you're here.
Well, thank you. And yeah, I'm one of your favorite sparring partners, maybe on the round table, but I always enjoy it.
Well, it's always great to have you there, and I always learn something from you. Anyway, Heather describes her parents as hippies and said her parents had a subscription to the Village Voice, and that'll do it, delivered to their door in Syracuse. So how did you find your way to this business career as the top business lady in New York State?
Wow, well, that's an interesting question. First, I should say that my dear aunt Sandy called me out on referring to them as hippies because they were not what she would say is the perception of hippie. They weren't slackers. They were very intellectual liberals. So I stand corrected, although I think more people would understand what I mean. I was born in the Peace Corps, so I don't know if that gives any credibility. Yes, in Tunisia, North Africa. And I've had the privilege of being able to go back and visit since I left when I was two. But it's a beautiful place. But your question was, how did I get here?
Yes.
So I don't know. I started college hoping to be a veterinarian. So it all makes sense, right?
Oh, absolutely.
And sort of fell into political science, worked in the assembly, loved it, worked for Mike Bragman, who was a Democrat from Syracuse, and then stayed on and worked for Assemblyman Greg Young, who was a Democrat from Westchester, and then went to law school. And I kind of loved politics, but then when I got to law school, I fell in love with criminal law. And I worked in the district attorney's office for a couple of years under Dan Dwyer, who was just a magnificent litigator, a huge personality, like sort of a law and order character kind of personality, and loved that. And so when I finished law school, I worked for a private firm doing defense work primarily, and then eventually started my own firm with a part-time job in the legislature. So I sort of split between criminal defense and working in the assembly, and landed a job along the way as the public defender of Rensselaer County, which is a job that I, to this day, would say was one of my favorite jobs I've ever had, and then went to the attorney general's office, so back into politics. And then lobbying. So it sounds like I can't hold a job, and I like to say that, but I've really loved the positions I've held along the way. And when I worked for the Senate, I worked for the Republicans. So I've worked for both sides of the aisle. I worked for a Republican Attorney General, Dennis Facco, who was very talented, very skilled Attorney General, and I think I learned a lot there. But when I was given the opportunity to go to the Business Council, the thing that appealed to me was it's not just an issue on behalf of a singular client, which is what you're doing with lobbying, but rather a breadth of issues, the policy, the underlying policy, which is what I really get engaged on. So that's how I got where I am. I would never describe myself as conservative by any stretch of the imagination, but I do think of myself as an advocate. And that is sort of the common thread between doing criminal defense and being, an advocate for business and a strong business climate. and I enjoy advocacy in general, I would say.
Well, I want all those people who are listening to understand that our friend Heather Bruschetti is really the top business lady in New York State. She represents the business community. And I've interviewed, since I'm so old, I've interviewed your predecessors many, many times. And it really is a hell of a big job. Do you ever wake up at night and say, boy, this is really something?
Well, it is always something. New York is a very difficult environment for anyone, and certainly I would say maybe not the most friendly to business politically of other states. But, you know, there's always opportunity. There's always work to be done. And we've got a really amazing infrastructure of higher education and workforce. And frankly, you know, our business community is very strong. It's a lot, but I really enjoy it. So I think I'd be bored if it was easy.
Well, Heather, you grew up in Syracuse, as I remember it, and you read The Village Voice. So your parents were sort of semi-hippieistic, which we know you don't like to have mentioned, but they were liberals. Would you describe yourself as a liberal now?
In some ways, I would say I'm a social liberal. Fiscal moderate. I like to say only in New York would anyone describe me as a fiscal conservative. But I'm sort of a free market, free entrepreneurship, and free individual rights. So I don't know that I would put myself in any particular bucket. My parents were, you know, card-carrying Liberal Party members. They were, you know, they had meetings sometimes at our house. So there was a lot of politics in the air in my youth.
Heather, you heard Governor Hochul's speech. Now, Governor Hochul's interesting in that my sense of it is, maybe I'm wrong, is that the moderate business community is pretty well behind her. As opposed to, saying, oh, this is some flaming liberal off to the far left. Am I wrong in that impression?
I'm not going to, we do as an organization, we do evaluate candidates and endorse in instances. So I'm not going to tip my hat as to what we as an organization will do. I'll say, certainly, she has made it clear that she wants New York to be more business friendly, as has Mayor Adams. And those are both very welcome remarks. Certainly, being from upstate, first upstate governor in over 100 years, first woman governor, those are all really exciting things. And she's very well known. She's been very engaged. Any opportunity that she's gotten to go in front of a chamber of commerce, to go speak to organizations, she's been at. So she's very well known, and I think people feel that she's approachable and reasonable and hoping to sort of get us on a very stable track in a time when that's pretty difficult to do. So, I think without saying or speaking on behalf of the entire business community, I would just say, you know, she's saying all the right things.
When you see Alphonse D'Amato raising money for her, what does that tell you?
That she has broad appeal. I think she's been very accessible, very open to talking to anyone and everyone. And she seems to be very thoughtful about who she listens to. And I think a lot of people appreciate that.
Now, you've spoken out. Quote, the Business Council applauds Governor Hochul's initiatives for promoting a stronger economy, increased private sector investments, and the creation of good-paying jobs. In particular, again, carrying on what you were saying, in particular, we were encouraged to see proposals for investments in economic development, small business relief, improved workforce development, and access to affordable child care, among others. Can you tell us more about those proposals?
I could talk for an hour about all of them. I would say this. We are in a very interesting moment in time. This is the first time since the beginning of 2000s, maybe, that the state has a budget surplus. So there's for the first time, there's no need to do additional revenue raising, which is, you know, code for new taxes. And New York is already in 49th place. Thank you, New Jersey, in terms of tax climate. So, you know, depending on what metric you're looking at, I mean, we have the highest personal income taxes in the country if you work in the metropolitan New York City area. So there's a lot of room for improvement. A focus on not looking for new revenue, a focus on trying to address some of the very big problems that we have right now in terms of workforce, a part of which is childcare also. Addressing those head on in a budget is exactly what leadership should do, and we are happy to see that. You know, last year in the budget, the legislature raised taxes at a time that they did not need to do so. It was somewhat gratuitous. And it doesn't help. If you look at our recovery, New York is in, we're last to come out. We have the highest unemployment in the country, other than, I think, Puerto Rico. So we're not recovering as quickly. Some of that is because of the sectors that were shut down and have struggled to get reopened because of waves here and there. But some of that is it's an extraordinarily difficult place to do business. And if you want to have a lot of generous, supportive programs, you need to have the revenue behind it. And if you want to have that revenue, you have to have a strong economy. And that means creating a climate where it's not a huge challenge to open a business and to run a business. So, you know, that doesn't get into the specifics of the policies, but you know, increasing eligibility for subsidized childcare is something that we think is, you know, a particular item that we think is very good. There's one thing that's not in the budget that we are hoping will get in the 30-day amendments, which is relief on the unemployment insurance fund. Because as many people may not be aware, unemployment insurance is 100% paid for by a tax on employers. It is not state-funded. It is not federal-funded. It is paid for by employer taxes, and it gets put in a pot that is called the UI Trust Fund. And when we need to access it, when we have high unemployment, that's where the money comes from. When we run out, which we did, we borrow money from the federal government to make sure that there's adequate funds to keep paying unemployment insurance. But that has to be paid back, and that gets paid back by employers. That is an additional tax on employers, and it will slow down our recovery. And the amount of money that we borrowed from the federal government is to the tune of $9 billion, which it represents an enormous, enormous debt that has to be paid for by employers. The state can and should take some of the federal funds that it got through ARPA and put that towards the UI Trust Fund, you know, in part recognizing that the reason that unemployment insurance was so high was because of actions taken by the state to shut down businesses. So that's what we think is something that is missing and should happen, and certainly will alleviate some of the burden on employers and allow them, frankly, the opportunity to hire more people and pay more people.
Okay, so I want to go back in time a little bit to the stuff that I find really fascinating. We have the death of Shelley Silver, the former speaker. You worked for Mike Bragman, who was one of his great liabilities and who tried to run against him, and he was put down into the basement, and that was the end of Mike Bragman. What do you see in that whole thing?
Okay, well, first off, let's be clear. I had nothing to do with any of that. When I worked for Mike Bragman, he was a freshman assemblyman.
I see.
Had no committees. I was in charge of wildlife management and volunteer firemen. They were both subcommittees, and Mario Cuomo was governor. So it was well before, and Shelley Silver was not the speaker. Stanley Fink was the speaker at the time, and then I'm going to blank out on who came afterwards. But
so what do you make as a top influential person in business in New York State? What do you make of the downfall of Shelley Silver, who ended up in prison? Do you think that politicians should be learning anything from this?
Well, I mean, first, how sad that, you know, that he died in a, you know, a hospital medical wing. I mean, I wouldn't wish that on anyone. I would say that, you know, he was obviously a huge figure in New York politics, and very influential, and that you know, now you see that a person's life can completely come undone. And we've seen numerous examples of that in the world that we live in. You know, we've seen more than one governor leave office. We've seen, you know, political leaders go to jail. And it's all really, really unfortunate, and it undermines people's confidence, I think, in leadership. And I just hope that at some point, you know, the temptations that happen when people are in office for a very long time, or the things that cause their personalities to start forgetting about what's right and wrong, that those elements will somehow go away. I don't think they will. I'm a big believer in, you know, especially with governors, I do think term limits are a good idea. But I think leadership term limits, not necessarily on holding office for legislators, but the term limits on holding leadership positions should be considered, because it's such an accumulation of power in one person, and entire systems get built around that person, and it's difficult. Now, I will say this. I worked for Senator, you know, Joe Bruno when he was the majority leader. I was proud to work for him. I was very happy to see him get acquitted at the end of the day. He can never get his reputation back. I have a view on what I think was the very wrong-headed nature of the pursuit of a conviction. It did destroy his life, and I felt very much that he tried very hard as majority leader to always do things in a transparent and above-board way. And tried to make sure that he wasn't doing anything that was inappropriate. But, you know, there's a high risk for anyone holding these positions of power that you'll become a target. And I would think that that would make you especially careful, but somehow that doesn't seem to have always been the case.
It doesn't always happen. Heather Bruschetti, let me ask you this. There are a lot of people who always say business doesn't pay its fair share of taxes. And we know about General Electric, for example, paying basically zero taxes because of the loopholes for wealthy corporations and individuals. And we know about Trump doing all of that. Does business get a bad name because of all of this?
Yes. And I think it's inaccurate. I actually, you know, had someone comment to me the other day that 92% of businesses don't pay any taxes. And I said, that's just wrong. They pay unemployment insurance taxes on every employee that they have. They pay property taxes. They pay, you know, business income taxes when they have business income. When a business does not generate business income, it does not pay those taxes when it takes a loss. And frankly, more likely to take a loss where in a place where you have high costs. And you've got sort of the, you know, the waxing and waning of the economy, right? A business doesn't make a profit every year. They might not make a profit one year and therefore not pay those income taxes, but that doesn't mean they're not paying sales tax and property tax. And you know, the largest property taxpayer in the state of New York is a business. The largest property taxpayer in the city of New York is a business. If you look at real property taxes broadly on a percentage basis, more is paid by business than is paid by individuals. So, you know, it's unfair to say that businesses don't pay taxes. That being said, you know, are there ways to avoid paying taxes based on where income is earned and how you describe that? Yes. And we work very hard on finding a consistent methodology so that it's spread out in a way that is logical and rational. So, but the idea that, you know, it's a parallel to a very high income individual, or basically high wealth individual who doesn't pay on their income because they don't need to, is not really a fair parallel. Because when you're accumulating wealth on behalf of shareholders, that's us. That's people who have 401ks, who have pensions, who have, I'm not saying everyone has those things, but understand that increasing the shareholder value is not something that is going into one single individual's pocket. It's a lot different than when we're talking about, you know, individual personal income taxes.
How about unions? How are they doing in your estimation? You know, a lot of people want unions. A lot of people have benefited because of unions. Business historically has had some antipathy towards unions. Can you bring us up to date on the way the land is laid out right now?
You know, I think that I have many, many members who have unionized workforce who have excellent relationships with their unions and have actually been able to solve problems in ways that that it's difficult if you do not have a unionized workforce. I think that there was a lot of after the Supreme Court decision a couple years ago, and of course I'm going to blank on the name of it off the top of my head, but there was a thinking that it basically said that you can't mandate a person in the public sector to pay union dues if they didn't want to, you know, so they have to opt in. And there was a lot of discussion about the idea that that was going to be, you know, very devastating to public sector unions. I don't think that's been the case. I think what it did is it forced some of them to really kind of demonstrate their value. In an environment where we are right now, where you've got, you know, more jobs than workforce, unions perform a very important function in terms of getting people upskilled and training. And in places where there aren't unions, we hope that, you know, employers will be able to access some of those workforce programs and training programs as well. But I don't think of it as an adversarial relationship. I think of it as different interests, you know, at work. And that's good. I'm a really big believer in point and counterpoint. I don't think you should ever be in an environment where one side is not allowed to speak. So I think that it's very healthy.
Heather Bruschetti, you have been interacting with many people involved in trying to get legal cannabis marijuana industry in the state. Now, I live across the border in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, which I think has become the pot capital of the world. And I can tell you there's some good things and bad things. Where are you on this current debate?
So I would say both with respect to recreational and medical, the lens at which the business council looked at the issue is that of employer. We just want to make sure that there are appropriate protections in place, that an employer actually can ask someone to go home if they're stoned. And when you don't have, you know, when you don't have basically the ability to test on the spot intoxication levels of marijuana, we wanted to make sure that the rules were clear so that we could have safe workplaces. And New York is, again, we're a unique state. We have something called the scaffold law, which basically says that any gravity-related injury on a work site is strict liability, right? There doesn't matter if the employee is intoxicated or if the person who is injured is intoxicated or under the influence of something. Mm-hmm. So you want to have the ability to actually say, you can't come to work because if something happens to you, or God forbid anyone else, there's strict liability on the part of the property owner, and that's not good. So that was the lens. Now the legislature did a very good job in addressing this. They agreed to treat marijuana basically the same as alcohol in the workplace, which is, you know, you can ask someone to leave if they're impaired. But it does provide, you know, sort of this interesting transitional issue where we have lots of employers who do drug testing. And, you know, is there any value in drug testing for marijuana when it could show a positive for something, activity that occurred that is legal now on the weekend? And the answer to that is probably no. We're going to have to come up with something different. But that's sort of my the context in which we think about it.
Heather Bruschetti, let me ask you this real quick. We only have 2 minutes to go. Let's talk a little bit about masks and mask mandates. We've seen the current mandate being decided in court. What do business leaders say about mandates?
Well, I think the number one thing they would say is, please don't make us the front of enforcement, because it has caused so much conflict. I mean, if you can imagine, if you have a retail store and the folks that are working in the store are high school or college students or senior citizens who are partially retired, and they're being asked to, you know, enforce the mask mandate. I would just ask people, please, if the rule is in place and indoor mask mandate is in place, put your mask on. Let's not force a confrontation. You know, you're asked to wear your pants into the store also, and that doesn't seem to be a big problem. For the limited period of time that you're going to be in a business, you know, please don't force a confrontation with them. But, you know, businesses don't want to see this virus spread, and they don't want to have confrontations with their customers. And I think that's the two main things I would want to leave people with on that.
We're out of time. Our guest has been Heather Borschetti, the president and CEO of the Business Council of New York State. Heather, we so appreciate your being here. We hope you'll come back again and talk to us some more. Thanks so much for joining us on the Capital Connection.
Well, and thank you for having me.
The Capital Connection is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. For copies, call 1-800-323-9262. That's 1-800-323-9262. Or visit us online anytime at WAMC.org, or you can even schedule a podcast. Ask for program number 2204 and join us again next week at this same time for another Political Conversation with Alan Chartok. I'm your producer, David Gustina. Thanks for listening.